Chapter 24. For livestock, there's not much change around here. We have 8 cows, 9 goats, and never enough chickens. We've been trying to make sure that in each village, the small fields, the fields too small to be plowed by government tractors, but too large to be turned over with spades by the old men and women who have to work them, are plowed and made ready to plant. The unit bought several plows and harrows, and others have been loaned by the French Service Agricole. I thought at first we might be able to go out, 2 or 3 of us, and do quite a bit ourselves, but as I realized how much there was, and that multiplied by 15 villages, I started a hunt for help. For a week, I went from one military authority to another, and at last found a wonderful quartermaster general who, instead of looking at me as though I were mad, immediately said, "How many horses and men do you want, and where shall I send them?" In a number of villages, the work is well underway, and within a week should be begun everywhere. I hope we can see it through. The war has been hotting up, as they say. But I'm not meant to be writing about any of that. Will the censor strike that through, I wonder? No matter. You'll read about it in the New York Times well before you get this letter. I have been so thoroughly enjoying my work, my play, my friends, and the weather that I feel as though I should throw a ring into the sea to placate local deities. Or is that only Venice? Miss Florence Lewes, Class of 1901, to her brother, Mr. Thomas Lewes. March 1918. Grecourt, France. It was 3 days before we could get a train, and how those hens cackled! It was utter cacophony in the living room of the new house. They'd just finished supper when Kate and Julia appeared out of nowhere, tugging 3 crates of hens between them. Anne had rushed to find some food to feed the prodigals. Florence was on her knees in front of the crates, inspecting the chickens, while Mrs. Barrett was looking on with an expression somewhere between apprehension and amusement, begging the chickens to spare the rug, which was only on loan. It was amazing, thought Emmy, how very full the room felt with just 2 more people in it. She should be delighted, she knew, but instead she felt vaguely apprehensive. Ever since the proposal to propose, she'd been living in a springtime sort of dream, all new grass and fluffy clouds. But Kate and Julia were, well, they weren't the dreaming sort. It didn't matter to Emmy that she wasn't entirely sure whether she was engaged or engaged to be engaged. All that mattered was that there was Will DeWitt in the world, holding the line, writing her letters that ended with, "Yours to be yours." But Kate would think it mattered, she knew. Kate would question his intentions and ask questions about the future, and they had discussed the future, they had. It was couched in poetry and daydream. Had we but world enough and time, we would sit down and think which way to walk and pass our long love's day. Will was particularly fond of the metaphysical poets. When they had world enough and time, that was one of their abiding preoccupations. Once the war was over, once they had world enough and time, what would they do with it? It was like a children's game, playing house in absentia. Walks, he suggested, amateur theatricals. He'd played Titania in a wig and someone's sister's frock at Harrow, and Emmy had teased him about it by return post. "Oh, Will, how thou art translated." It was Shakespeare, and therefore against the rules, but he'd brought it on himself. It was all very silly, and the censors probably thought they were off their heads, or engaging in the most Byzantine sort of cipher known to man, but Emmy had never been happier, had never imagined being so happy, even if she knew that it was a fool's paradise, that at any moment a German sniper or bomber could end it all with one well-placed missile. But they weren't to think of that. They'd promised each other. Like an old-fashioned sundial, they would count only the happy hours. She didn't mistrust Will or his intentions, only the war itself. And maybe, just a bit, herself. But she didn't think Kate or Julia would see it that way. And this new Kate and Julia, a Kate and Julia who worked together, who had shared jokes and seemed to understand each other's minds, that was more unsettling still. Trying to make up for her ungenerous thoughts, Emmy took one of the odd two-handled bowls from Anne and brought it to Kate.
Did you keep the chickens in the hotel all that time?
Julia looked surprisingly human, with her forehead smudged with soot from the train, her cheeks flushed from their long walk from the station, and her skirt stained with goodness only knew what from the chickens. Madame would have dearly liked to evict us, but Kate fed her a dreadful line about war service and doing one's bit. It wasn't a line, it was all true. Kate's lips quivered with suppressed amusement. But she couldn't very well throw us and our chickens out after that.
I'm surprised she didn't just stick them in the soup pot, said Nell.
And take away a chicken from the service of France? Drawled Julia, raising her brows dramatically. Kate balled up her cloth napkin and lobbed it at her. Children, children, protested Mrs. Barrett, but she was laughing too. And then the first bomb fell, making the walls of the house shake and George Washington fall face forward on the table.
Oh no, we forgot the curtains.
Emmy stumbled to the windows. She yanked the fabric so hard she nearly brought the whole curtain down. Another crash followed the first, closer this time. The hens cackled in distress in their coops, and outside they could hear a dog yelping.
The pantry!
Exclaimed Alice, and made a dash to extinguish the lamps there. A moment later, the house was plunged into darkness.
Ow! Are you all right?
Emmy called, bracing one hand against the piano to orient herself.
The doorframe hit me, said Alice, groping her way back into the room. Better than a bomb, said Nell.
For the benefit of their returning members, she added,
That's the great drawback of the new house. The lighted windows are a positive invitation to the Hun to use as target practice. It was careless of us to forget to draw the curtains, said Emmy remorsefully. They keep telling us it will be the big push any day now.
And by they, you mean your British friends? Asked Kate, and Emmy could practically hear all the things she wasn't saying.
Well, they are the ones who would know, said Emmy.
They waited in silence in the dark for a few moments, listening. When no further bombs fell, Mrs. Barrett said in bracing tones, I think we can risk one lamp. A moment later, a match was struck. Mrs. Barrett fiddled with the wick. A faint flame flickered and caught, sending a rosy glow throughout the room.
Welcome home, said Nell from her spot on the rug with her legs curled under her. Aren't you glad you're back?
Yes, surprisingly, said Kate, draining the rest of her soup. Bombs and all. Sitting on the piano bench, looking around the room in the dim light at all the familiar faces brought into high relief by the interplay of light and shadow, Emmy thought how very odd it was what one was able to become accustomed to. Being bombarded had become merely a minor irritation, like midges at a picnic. They'd become too used to it to take it seriously. Would she have ever thought that possible back in New York? She'd changed, she realized. They'd all changed. Kate set aside her soup cup.
We weren't at all sure we'd be able to get back. My pass was all right, but Julia's had expired, and I wasn't sure I could manage all three crates on my own, and after what we'd paid for them, I certainly wasn't going to leave them.
I'm glad to know you only brought me along for the chickens, said Julia bitingly.
So what did you do?
Asked Anne, perched on the edge of a bench made by her own students. Anne was terribly proud of that bench, the product of her woodworking classes. She sat on it at every opportunity.
Shenanigans, said Julia. Skullduggery, sleight of hand. Our Kate here turns out to be an accomplished charlatan.
That's all nonsense. Scoffed Kate, but Emmy could tell she was pleased.
When the man came for our passes, I might just have happened to drop one of the crates.
Just happened? The thing practically exploded, retorted Julia. There were feathers everywhere, people squawking, hens squawking.
Poor things.
Florence patted a chicken crate.
Were they all right?
Were they all right?
Emmy had never heard Julia so voluble. They were having a grand time. They got into someone's lunch and scattered war bread everywhere. The guard tried to make a run for it and tripped over a piece of broken crate. After that, no one was going to bother with a little thing like passes.
We did get them all back in the crate, Kate reassured Florence. And strung the broken bits back together with twine. I never meant for the box to break.
It was a good thing it did, said Julia cynically. Or they'd have had me off the train, chickens or no chickens.
Well, I know some people who'll be very grateful for these, said Florence. One woman in Offoy told me that she desperately needs another chicken because she has only one and it's pining for company.
Do chickens pine? Asked Kate skeptically.
Why shouldn't they? It's miserable being left all alone, said Alice, with a little too much feeling.
You could send the poor hen one of Emmy's roosters, said Nell mischievously. A barnyard romance might take its mind off things.
It works for some, said Gwen loftily, pointedly looking at Emmy and Nell, both of whom she considered sunk beneath reproach. Florence was too busy with the chickens to realize she was being included in the ranks of the fallen.
Has the rooster a mustache? Inquired Julia blandly. A dubious mustache, perhaps?
I'm sure the roosters will be delighted by the company, as are we, Mrs. Barrett stepped in, smoothly turning the conversation. I had meant you to have a longer rest, but I'm beyond glad to have you both back. Pass or no pass, the number of people we've had to turn away from the dispensary is nothing short of heartbreaking. Dr. Stapleton has been doing his best, but with his own work at the Red Cross Hospital.
Kate looked at Julia, and some sort of unspoken message passed between them.
About that, said Kate innocently. Now that Dr. Prine is back, wouldn't it be best to release Dr. Stapleton to his regular duties? We wouldn't want to keep him from his war work.
But we've still only one doctor.
With no insult to your abilities, Dr. Prine, said Mrs. Barrett, smiling at Julia. I don't want you collapsing from overwork.
I won't, said Julia. She waved a hand imperiously in Gwen's general direction. Miss Mills can assist me. She's more than capable. Everyone, including Gwen Mills, stared at Julia. Julia had, in the past, been cutting about people who took one nursing course and considered themselves medical professionals and had done everything in her power to damp what she considered Gwen's medical pretensions.
Why, yes, naturally, Gwen floundered. I'd be more than delighted.
You see, said Julia coolly, there's no need to strain the resources of the Red Cross.
And there's Miss Van Alden, said Kate, turning to Emmy. I've seen her administer first aid. She saved a child from extensive burns our first week here.
That was just Ambreen, said Emmy, confused and pleased.
At least she would have been pleased if she didn't have the feeling that she was being used as a pawn in an obscure game set up by Julia and executed by Kate.
Anyone would know how.
I didn't, said Kate. After all her years of social work, Miss Van Alden is an accomplished practical nurse, and she's a wonder with children.
Except for Zaylee, said Emmy.
Zaylee is a law unto herself, said Kate fondly. Zaylee and that goat of hers.
Minerva butted Dr. Stapleton last week, contributed Nell, grinning. He was bending over a patient, and
we can make a trial of it, broke in Mrs. Barrett. It's only until the rest of the unit gets their passes.
Oh, bother. There go the planes again. Do you think those are our boys this time?
Is the big push really coming? Kate asked Emmy as they prepared for bed, having made a mad dash across the lawn to their barrack. Canvas was tacked over the windows, and the only light was the dim glow of the stove.
That's what we've been told, but they've been saying it constantly since you left, so we've just been going on pretty much as normal.
Kate was shaking out her blankets, airing them after her long absence.
What does Captain Biscuit say?
His name is DeWitt.
Maybe it was because she knew Will was sensitive on the topic. Maybe it was because she'd spent her whole life bearing the brunt of being her mother's daughter, but it came out sharper than Emmy had intended.
And he doesn't say anything.
He can't. You know that.
All right.
Kate smoothed down the topmost blanket. In the tone of one holding out an olive branch, she asked, "What else has happened since I left?"
"Well, you know, it's mostly been the planting."
Anything to keep Kate from digging into Will. Emmy found she deeply, deeply didn't want to discuss Will with Kate, because Kate would pick and pick and pick, and Emmy didn't think she could bear it. Emmy plunked down on her own bed, starting the complicated process of letting down her hair, which always wound up tangled around her pins.
"We had the hardest time getting Canny Z plowed. The French authorities were supposed to be doing it, but hadn't, so I had to find the man in charge of the region, who turned out to be all the way across the river in Bunay. He said he'd tractors, but no idea where to send them. I finally had to set up a sort of parley at the old railroad crossing at Canny Z, you know the spot, with the chef de tracteurs, the mayor, and all the women who own land, and we had to walk the fields, actually pace them out, with the owners pointing out marking stones or drawing lines in the dirt with their spades. You wouldn't believe all the wrangling, but we finally got them all sorted out and the tractors in, and now they're plowing away like anything. Florence has come to some sort of arrangement with the British to get it all harrowed next. Did you even know there was such a thing as harrowing before we came here?"
"No," said Kate. "Not at all. I thought vegetables came from the greengrocer." Emmy babbled on.
"Nell and Anne are going great guns on their social centers. You'd never know Verlaine and Canny Z. They've got climbing ropes and ladders for physical education, and even a cinema machine. You wouldn't believe how popular it's been. We've had Tommies wandering in pretending they were just passing by."
Oh dear. She'd brought them back to the dangerous topic of Englishmen. Emmy cast about for another neutral topic.
"You'll never imagine. Alice taught me to drive."
"You're driving?" Kate looked unflatteringly alarmed.
"But you always said..." "I know, but we can always use another driver. I'm only taking the wheel when there isn't someone else."
Emmy caught herself before she could keep apologizing. There was nothing to apologize for. Why shouldn't she drive? Will didn't seem to see anything odd in her taking the wheel. He'd encouraged her in it. Emmy squared her shoulders.
"It's really not as hard as I thought it would be. Alice thinks I should go to Paris and get my license."
"Hmm," said Kate. And that single syllable hurt Emmy more than any number of words.
"We've been ridiculously busy since you left," Emmy said stridently,
wanting to show Kate what they'd done without her, what they could do.
"Mrs. Barrett put us all on a new schedule so we could take over the villages for the girls who aren't here yet. I've had Dewey. It used to be Ethel's, remember?"
Kate paused in drawing off her boots. "Yes, she wrote an article about it, didn't she? All about the noble French peasant and the even nobler Smith women." Emmy couldn't help but bristle at Kate's casual tone.
"Well, she should have been working at it instead of writing about it. The conditions there are unthinkable. We've been delivering beds and mattresses for months, but there were children sleeping on floors."
It had broken Emmy's heart to see them, covered with chilblains and sores. "She certainly didn't say that in her article," said Kate slowly, "or in her reports."
"Are you sure?"
It was the visitor's job to report this sort of thing, to make sure appropriate medical care and supplies were delivered. The reports went to Kate, who then allocated whatever was needed.
"She must have said something, put in for supplies.
The store went there, of course," said Kate, putting her boots by her cot, lining them up ever so precisely. "I know milk was delivered. Other than that, Ethel didn't put in for many extra supplies. I'd assumed it must be in better condition."
"In better condition?"
Corcelle, which had come to her in a shambles with 50 children, none of them well, looked like a prosperous Mecca in contrast to Dewey. Emmy could feel tears sting the back of her eyes just thinking of it, how it had looked when she had visited for the first time last week.
"There was one old man with nothing to eat with but an old tin can. He hadn't even a spoon. Just that ancient tin can."
"Was his home out of the way? Could Ethel have missed him?" asked Kate.
"If so," said Emmy,
She missed nearly everyone. Emmy didn't understand how Ethel could have visited week after week and seen only medieval ruins and quaint stories and never noticed that there were children shivering in rags. In Courcelle, which had been so terribly devastated, they had provided beds for all the children, small stoves to cook on, pots and pans and plates and blankets. Emmy had finished delivering the basic necessities before Christmas and had long since moved on to the second part of their plans, wrangling government barracks to house people living in shacks and shanties, a properly equipped schoolhouse, books, athletic equipment, and of course, livestock and planting. If Emmy had ever doubted that what they were doing made a difference, she had seen it then when she had visited Dewey. "I gave him the fork and spoon and bowl out of my haversack, and you would have thought I'd given him something marvelous and rare, he was so delighted. It made me sick, Kate." Emmy looked at her roommate, trying to impress upon her the seriousness of it all. "I'm not exaggerating, really I'm not. There are people there living like our people were back in September. All of the children have lice and not a washtub among them. I don't care what I have to do to get them. I'm going back with scissors and washtubs and fine-toothed combs. And a pump. They hadn't even a village pump yet, Kate." Kate straightened. Emmy could practically see her brain ticking away, listing tasks. "We'll need to put in a request with the Red Cross. I put in a request while you were away in Paris." It was part of her job, making requests for materials, part of the job Ethel hadn't been doing. There was no reason for Kate to think Emmy was as slapdash as Ethel. "Of course you did," said Kate quickly. "I'm sure you have it all in hand. It's a good thing the people of Dewey have you to look after them now." Emmy frowned at Kate. "I am perfectly capable, you know." Kate paused in putting clothes away in the trunk that doubled as nightstand and armoire.
"Isn't that what I just said?"
"Yes, but you shouldn't have to say it," said Emmy. "When you say it, it sounds like you don't mean it."
Kate looked at her with genuine confusion.
"Do you mean you don't want me to tell you when you're doing something well?"
She should just leave it, Emmy knew. She hardly knew what she meant herself, but she couldn't seem to stop herself.
"When you keep telling me what a good job I'm doing, it makes me feel like someone's golden retriever, as if you're patting me on the head for fetching a stick."
As if Kate were looking down at her from on high and judging.
"You don't keep telling Alice what a marvelous job she's doing with the machines, or Anne how special she is for teaching woodworking."
"They don't need to be told," said Kate worriedly. "You were so low this winter." There was a reason she'd been so low, because Kate had made her feel useless.
"I'm not a child, Kate. You don't need to hand out treats to me for good behavior. I've spent years doing social work. You and my mother may not think much of it, but I did learn something from it. Not much, but something."
"I never said I thought nothing of it," protested Kate.
"No, but you thought it."
The way Kate went still told Emmy all she needed to know.
"It's not just that. You never made a fuss about any of the others going off on their own. Ethel tramped all around the countryside without a by your leave. Anne walks by herself to Offoy all the time. Well, that's because I can trust them to find their way back by supper," said Kate, bright spots of color showing on her cheeks. "And not send me out looking for them after dark in a snowstorm. You didn't have to come get me."
Emmy had been thinking it for weeks now, without daring to say it.
"If you hadn't come after me, I would have stayed the night in Courcelle. It was only because you came running after me that we wound up lost in a snowstorm with those dreadful men.
Was I supposed to leave you unaccounted for overnight?"
"Yes."
Emmy was close to tears.
"Yes, you should have trusted that I had the sense to stay in place. I told you where I was going. You knew where I was going. If you'd asked Red Cross Dave, he could have told you he'd left me there safely. There was no reason for coming after me as though I were a child who'd wandered off into the woods."
"Breadcrumbs and witches," said Kate sarcastically. Kate always got sarcastic when she was upset. Emmy had always known that about her. She had always accepted it meekly before.
Pardon me for looking after the welfare of the unit. Some of us have more to do than gadding about with plausible Englishmen.
Emmy wasn't sure which infuriated her more, the plausible or the gadding.
Englishman, Kate. One Englishman. And I'm hardly gadding. I've been working like a mule while you've been lounging in Paris.
Kate flinched as if she'd been struck. Nothing hurt Kate more than being accused of idleness.
You know I didn't want to go. But you did. And it was probably a good thing, too. It showed us we could all get on without you.
Emmy knew it was cruel, knew it even before she saw Kate's fine-boned face go white. That was the worst of it. They knew too well how to hurt each other.
As for that Englishman you so despise, at least he treats me like a person, not a golden retriever.
I never treated you like a golden retriever. Kate veered back to the attack.
What do you know about him, really? Only what he tells you.
Emmy ached all over, but she couldn't seem to stop. Neither of them could. The only way to end the fight was to give in, and she was sick of being the one giving in.
Because my judgment isn't to be trusted? That's what you mean, isn't it? You've known him for such a little time and in such strange circumstances. He might have half a dozen wives in an attic in England, Emmy, or a fiancé waiting for him, or gambling debts, or some other noxious behavior we know nothing about.
Kate's hands were clenched into fists at her sides.
You know I only want what's best for you. Do you? Did you? All those years when you didn't write back?
Emmy could taste bile in the back of her throat. The old hurts pushed up from the very bottom of her gut, pushed up from where she'd hidden them all these years.
One minute you were my best friend in the world, and the next you were just gone.
I took a teaching position, said Kate hoarsely.
You knew that. Did your students tie up your hands? Steal your ink? I wrote to you and wrote to you and wrote to you. Don't tell me you wrote back,
said Emmy passionately as Kate opened her mouth.
Two lines every 6 months hardly counts. I told myself it was because you were working and busy and didn't have the time, but maybe it was that you just didn't want to be bothered with me anymore.
Kate's mouth opened and then closed again. She shook her head, entirely at a loss for words.
I made you come out here. I know you didn't want to, and I know you feel obligated to take care of me.
The words felt like knives. Every single one tore at Emmy's throat.
But you don't have to anymore. I'd rather fail of my own accord than have you holding me up when you don't want to.
Kate's knuckles were white against the edge of her cot.
You say that now. I mean it!
Stung, Emmy retorted.
I know I've made mistakes, but you have too, Kate. What about Dewey? You should have seen something was wrong with Ethel's reports.
Kate's throat worked, as if she was finding it hard to swallow.
When was I meant to do that?
Her voice crackled with frustration.
When I was reading 15 other reports? When I was driving the truck to take the doctors to every village between here and creation? I can't do everything!
No, you can't. Emmy sat back on her bed, feeling exhausted and sad. She wasn't angry anymore. She wasn't sure what she was. She felt about 100 years old.
We're meant to be a unit, Kate. We're meant to work together. Not you running around trying to do everything and making yourself and everyone else miserable. That's what Mrs. Barrett has been trying to tell you. That's why she sent you away.
So I wouldn't make you all miserable? Kate looked absolutely ghastly, like someone in the last stages of consumption.
You try making all the decisions. But you shouldn't have to make all the decisions. That's just the point.
Emmy clasped her hands together in her lap, trying to make Kate understand, trying to salvage something.
If you trusted any of the rest of us just a little.
With a swift movement, Kate extinguished the small lamp sitting on her steamer trunk. She rolled herself in her bedroll, turning her neatly braided head away from Emmy.
It's a good thing you have Mrs. Barrett then, isn't it?
Chapter 25.
I've been meaning to thank you for my Christmas boots. I got some strange looks for them in Paris, but I've got the warmest, driest feet in the unit and wouldn't take them off for anything. We may not have terribly much more time here. There's not much I can tell you without running afoul of the censor, but I'm well and working hard, and you're not to worry. We've had some measles in the unit. I'm so glad I got it out of the way all those years ago, although I imagine it wasn't much fun for you. I don't remember much of it, but I do remember your reading me the same book over and over and over. Things are a bit tense here, but the unit has brave friends holding the line. There are even some of our very own boys from Brooklyn in the engineers. We had a mass at the village church our first month here, and the engineers sent over 6 of the men who were Catholic. I'm pretty sure I recognized at least one boy from St. Mary's, although I'm very glad Matt and Timmy and Pat and Johnny are safe home and not here with us. New York seems a long way off just now. I feel like a soldier writing his farewell letter home before going into action, which is very silly of me. I'll write again soon, and you'll undoubtedly hear from the papers whatever happens long before this gets to you. I'm sorry if this is muddled. The guns have been going nonstop for 2 days, so it's hard to think, let alone write. I know I don't write enough, but I do love you all. Miss Catherine Moran, class of 1911, assistant director, to her mother, Mrs. Frances Shaughnessy. March 1918, Grecourt, France. Mrs. Barrett left on a Monday.
You didn't have to see me off, Mrs. Barrett said, drawing on her gloves and checking once again to see that she had her feuille bleue and carnet rouge, the papers that gave her access in and out of the war zone. I'm only gone for a week. It's hardly a call for a committee. Kate shielded her eyes against the sun rising over the ruined walls of the chateau.
No, but I just wondered if you had any last instructions, my dear.
Mrs. Barrett put her gloved hand over Kate's. You girls have the work well in hand. Just go on doing what you're doing. And take some time for play. Alice and Nell tell me the Englishmen quartered at Ambleu have a cinema going in an old barn. You ought to go with them once or twice. Kate blinked against the sun. Since her fight with Emmy, she'd felt strangely raw, as though her shell had been pried off her like a lobster, and every passing breeze touched a nerve.
Is that an order?
Consider it a suggestion, said Mrs. Barrett. A strong suggestion. Which, thought Kate, was just what Emmy had been telling her. That leading didn't mean ordering people about, it meant trusting them to make their own decisions. But what if that didn't work? What if the decisions they made were the wrong ones? It was fine for Emmy to complain about Kate treating her like a child. Kate had never wanted to be here in the first place. It was Emmy who had dragged her here, Emmy who had insisted she needed her. If she was treating Emmy like a child, it was because Emmy asked to be treated like a child. But it hit Kate in the gut, all the same. She'd thought they'd been happy at Smith. It had seemed to work then. Emmy provided all the affection, and Kate provided the practical skills, and between them, they balanced out rather nicely. She'd been happy to help Emmy with her Latin, and if they joked about things like Emmy being hopeless at remembering directions, well, it was a fond joke. She'd never thought Emmy minded. It was Emmy who was always reminding everyone that she would never have got through Smith without Kate, which Kate had always taken as just another sign of noblesse oblige, Emmy trying to make her feel important, make up for the difference in their situations. It had never occurred to her that Emmy might have actually believed it, or that Emmy might have thought she hadn't written after Smith because she didn't want to be bothered with her. She should tell Emmy the truth, Kate knew, but the idea of turning herself inside out, laying all her insecurities bare, she just couldn't. She didn't have time for this, thought Kate savagely. Mrs. Barrett was leaving, and there were a million tasks to be accomplished, and a German army massing somewhere just to the east. When are you seeing Mr. Hunt and Mr. Folks? Kate asked, trying to keep herself brisk and businesslike. Wednesday morning. Mrs. Barrett made a face. The Red Cross might have picked a better time for a meeting. But at least it means I can work on our passes in person instead of wasting whole days writing letters which I am assured that no one ever bothers to open.
We'll make sure to get the last of the harrowing done while you're gone, Kate said immediately. And you don't need to tell me. I know you will.
Joseph, one of the soldiers loaned to them for heavy work, was waiting with a horse and cart to drive Mrs. Barrett to the train station. It might be only the 18th of March, but spring had come on with a vengeance. The ground was thick with early blooming anemones, and the air was fresh with the smell of plowed earth and growing things, which made most of them joyous and made Alice sneeze. Mrs. Barrett paused for a moment, looking back at the park, dotted with anemones, the water tower wrapped in red vines, the barracks with their crooked signs reading Seeley, Comstock, and Burton. They had named their barracks after the past presidents of Smith College.
I do hate to go just now. Gray Corps has never been so hard to leave as it has been this week.
Don't go, Kate wanted to say. Don't leave me to do this on my own, which was absurd. She'd never wanted Mrs. Barrett here in the first place.
You didn't see the best of it coming in winter.
No, but I saw the best of all of you, said Mrs. Barrett, smiling at her with warm, tired brown eyes.
Goodness, I can't think why I'm being such a watering pot. It's only a week. I'll be back with you all by Saturday.
Don't stay away too long, said Kate, only half joking. You don't want to miss the big drive.
If we had a penny for every time we were told it was to be the big drive, we could afford to feed and clothe every child in France.
Mrs. Barrett lifted her bag and started for the cart, keeping carefully to the duck walk. She was wearing her Paris shoes, as if she were already gone, had already shaken off the mud of Gray Corps.
I'll be very put out with the Kaiser if he tries to visit before I get back.
We'll be sure to tell him that, said Kate.
Don't laugh, said Mrs. Barrett. The force of the British Army is one thing. The fury of a Smith woman is quite another.
She climbed into the cart and was gone. Kate stood there for a moment, watching as the cart trundled over the moat and down the long alley that had once been lined by poplars. She didn't delude herself that Mrs. Barrett had passed control of the unit to her out of any confidence in her abilities. It was simply that she was assistant director, and in the absence of the director, it was expected that the assistant would take charge. It hurt her to admit it, but they'd all been happier since Mrs. Barrett had come. It wasn't just the creature comforts, like the new house and the housekeeper and a somewhat better quality of war bread. It was, Kate realized, standing there in the morning chill, the combination of having an ultimate authority, someone who wasn't one of them, and knowing that she trusted them to know what to do. Mrs. Barrett had taken Julia's and Kate's word absolutely on sending Dr. Stapleton away. She hadn't asked any questions, she hadn't argued the point, she'd just done it, adding as her only provision that Julia not struggle in silence, but tell her immediately if the work was too much. The change in Julia had been wonderful. She'd set about ordering her medical department with ferocious satisfaction. Kate had never seen Julia this close to happy. Kate stared at the sign next to the moat, the battered sign reading Bon à boire. It wasn't Bon à boire, this. It was a bitter draft. Realizing that maybe Emmy had been right, maybe there was something to be learned from Mrs. Barrett, that maybe leading wasn't so much telling as trusting. Kate wasn't very good at trusting. Her motto had always been, if you want something done, do it yourself. But it seemed that wasn't what it took for the unit to run. It was only a week, Kate told herself, as she went in to join the others for breakfast. There was only so much that could go wrong in a week. As Kate came in, Emmy focused hard on pouring cream into her coffee. Usually, when they disagreed about anything, or even when they hadn't, Emmy fell over herself to apologize. But not this time. Nell raised a cup to Kate.
Hail our interim director. Do you have any directions for us?
Kate sank into her seat. The seat at the head of the table that had been Mrs. Rutherford's and Dr. Stringfellow's, and then Mrs. Barrett's, and was now, briefly, Kate's, and forced a smile.
Only carry on, as our British friends would say.
Are you sure you're feeling quite well? Asked Nell.
Gwen isn't, broke in Alice. She's got a rash across her face, and she's shivering like anything. She says the sun hurts her eyes. That caught Emmy's attention. She looked up in alarm.
Oh, that sounds like measles. I saw a lot of it in New York. Once it gets started in the tenements, it spreads something terrible. Whole families sick at once.
Kate had caught it as a child, in a building Emmy would undoubtedly have considered a tenement. Kate remembered her mother sponging her head with a damp cloth, wringing it out, and starting again. She remembered how her eyes had stung and the soft sound of her mother's voice singing to her.
Do we know how many of our people have had it? Kate asked.
Gwen's been working in the infirmary, said Alice, fidgeting in her chair. She must have seen hundreds of people last week. She might have given it to any of them.
Not the children, though, said Kate. Gwen was an excellent nurse, with adults. Children she saw as small, inferior adults who behaved in unpardonably irrational ways and had no patience with them.
Emmy's been seeing to the children.
Kate looked at Emmy, feeling absurdly like she was trying to curry her favor to make up for everything she wasn't ready to admit to doing wrong.
Hands up, said Julia. Who here has had it?
Everyone raised their hands except Nell, who bit her lip and fiddled with her coffee cup.
I haven't. My brother got it, but my mother sent me away in time.
Kate put down her napkin.
The first thing to do is get Gwen into quarantine. I can run Gwen over to the Red Cross Hospital in Nell, if everyone agrees, she added belatedly.
Julia pushed back her chair.
I'll come with you to see Gwen settled, and then Emmy and I can start making the rounds of the villages to check everyone with whom Gwen came into contact over the last 2 weeks, if our interim director permits this alteration of the schedule.
Your interim director applauds this alteration of the schedule, said Kate.
Nell, if you wouldn't mind.
I'll take over Emmy's classes for the next 2 days, said Nell promptly. Don't worry.
There's always something to worry about, said Florence, placidly eating bread and jam. If it's not measles, it's the big drive.
On the plus side, Alice said brightly, it's hard to worry about the big drive when we have a measles epidemic to worry about. My mother always used to say that if your head hurt, you should stamp hard on your foot.
Julia stared at her.
That's dreadful advice.
It does stop you thinking about your head, said Alice.
Yes, until you break a toe.
Julia looked hard at Alice.
Don't break a toe.
Gwen would contract measles the day Mrs. Barrett left, thought Kate, bitterly and unfairly, as she drove to the Red Cross Hospital in Nell, Julia in the back with Gwen, who was covered in raised red spots and running a worryingly high temperature. Alice was wrong, Kate decided. It was quite possible to worry about both a measles epidemic and the big drive. If this hit their villages, if this hit the troops, the planes thrummed overhead, the noise making Kate's back and shoulders tense, smoke like candy floss spinning through the air as men high in the clouds did their best to murder each other in the name of king and country. It was a relief to arrive at the hospital, to hand Gwen off to a nurse in a white apron who said cheerfully that she'd seen worse cases. The hospital had been a tuberculosis pavilion before the war. There was something about the airy rooms, the large windows, and the garden around it that made one feel inherently peaceful. It was certainly better, decided Kate, than putting Gwen into quarantine in one of the barracks, where the thin walls and small windows let in a great deal of cold, but very little light or air. She'd be more comfortable and better cared for here.
Now let's just hope she didn't spread it, said Julia as they headed back out to the truck.
It's the nearer villages that are the concern. She broke off as a man stopped in front of them on his way to the ward.
Hello, said Dr. Stapleton. I thought that was the unit truck out front. Missing me already?
It sounded so charming the way he said it, with a big, self-deprecating grin. If Kate hadn't known better, she would have smiled back. Instead, she stepped in front of Julia, shielding her as best she could. We just dropped off a measles case. Gwen Mills.
She's worn herself out, I see.
Dr. Stapleton said gravely, but he couldn't quite hide a hint of smugness.
I would have been happy to continue visiting.
But we weren't happy to have you visiting, said Kate bluntly. It would have been easier to simply walk away, to pretend this wasn't her quarrel, but it was. She'd promised Julia.
You aren't wanted, Dr. Stapleton. You aren't wanted and you aren't needed.
He looked over Kate's head at Julia, then back down at Kate.
You're not listening to sour grapes, are you? If Julia's been talking nonsense.
I've known Dr. Prine for over a decade, said Kate sharply. I've never known her to speak nonsense. And I'll tell you something, Dr. Stapleton. We know. We know what you are. If you ever prey on another woman again, we'll be sure every hospital in America knows it. You won't find a single practice to employ you. You'll be lucky to get a job as a Navy surgeon in the South Seas, where there's not a woman within 100 miles and nothing to stare at but the bottom of a bottle.
Dr. Stapleton's face was as white as his collar and cuffs. He gave an entirely unconvincing laugh.
I have no idea what you're talking about, but you certainly have a picturesque way of expressing it.
As two nurses in Red Cross uniforms passed by, he added loudly,
You don't need to worry. I'll look in on your measles case for you.
I wouldn't if I were you, Julia said from behind Kate, sounding remote but entirely in possession of herself. Measles can make you sterile, or worse.
Dr. Stapleton looked entirely discomfited.
Well, naturally. That is...
Goodbye, John, Julia said, and stalked out with Kate following behind.
Neither of them said anything until they were safely in the truck. Then Julia glanced sideways at Kate, her mouth twisting with delicate irony.
A Navy surgeon in the South Seas?
Kate grimaced. It was the first thing that popped into my head. I just wanted something suitably remote.
There was silence for a moment as Kate maneuvered around a very large, extremely top-heavy farm cart. Once they were past it, Julia said quietly,
Thank you.
We stand together, remember? Besides, you didn't need me. You should have seen him sweat when you mentioned he might lose his manhood.
Julia permitted herself a little smile.
I knew that would hit him where it hurts. He mentioned once that he hadn't had measles.
At least we know Gwen's safe from him, said Kate. But this means you're back to doing all the medical work on your own.
Julia looked at Kate levelly.
Not entirely on my own, she said.
Oh, don't go all sentimental on me. You're getting as bad as Emmy.
Over the next 3 days, with Emmy on hand as nurse, Julia examined every adult and child in Ambleu, Esmerie-Allon, and Bruyères, the three villages with which Gwen had had contact. Julia delivered her report over a late dinner on Wednesday night. They'd kept dinner back for Alice, Nell, and Florence, who had been to the movies in Ambleu that night. With only 7 left at Graycourt and the constant hiss of aerial battle overhead, the unit was clinging together as much as possible, reduced to its core.
What's the diagnosis? Asked Kate, trying to sound jaunty, even though she was really, truly, desperately afraid. A measles epidemic could decimate their villages.
8 cases of pneumonia, 2 of tetanus, and more syphilis than is socially acceptable. Said Julia, spearing a braised turnip from the serving platter.
But no measles.
Thank goodness, said Kate, with feeling.
Don't break out the fatted calf yet, said Julia. There's still time. We'll know in about 2 weeks if Gwen spread it to anyone. Fortunately, there was a brutal epidemic last spring. Anyone who was going to get it, got it. It's only the children under the age of 1 we have to worry about. And the troops, but they have their own doctors. They're not our concern.
Speaking of the troops, Alice poked at her stew, trying to sound casual and failing utterly. The Esmerie-Allon boys couldn't join us tonight. We got word they'd received marching orders.
The room suddenly seemed a little darker, the shadows cast by the lamps more ominous. The tension in the room was palpable, like the heavy air before an electric storm.
Defiantly, Nell shoveled more stew onto her plate, as though to show she wasn't the least bit concerned.
Colonel Hayes came over midway through the movie and told us that the big drive is starting tonight. It didn't stop him watching the rest of the film, so I can't imagine there's anything much to worry about.
Well, if he has time to go to the pictures, began Kate, but the rest of her words were lost as an enormous blast shook the walls of the new house. Nell dropped the serving spoon, splattering stew across the tablecloth. Anne stared wildly around the room.
What was that? It didn't sound like a bomb, said Emmy, wide-eyed. Whatever it was, it's ruined Mrs. Barrett's linen tablecloth.
Nell scrubbed awkwardly at the tablecloth with her napkin.
Oh, bother. Does anyone have some salt before it stains?
Try some water first, suggested Florence. Alice had gone an unfortunate greenish color.
My mother swears by a mix of baking powder, talcum, and cornstarch.
Kate looked down from the head of the table at the other six remaining members of the unit. Nell was scrubbing maniacally at the tablecloth. Emmy was clinging to her water goblet for dear life. Even Florence, imperturbable Florence, had cocked her head, listening, and her usually placid face had a strained look about it. They were all scared out of their wits, but determined to pretend, to their last breath, that they were quite all right and it was just a bit of bother, with nothing more to worry about than a stained tablecloth. And Kate was just as bad as the rest of them. What's wrong with us? Kate wondered. Maybe, she thought madly, it would be easier if they just admitted they were all scared out of their wits instead of all desperately pretending to be fascinated by the best method for getting grease out of linen. Another boom, as loud as the last, made them all dive for the ground.
At least it's not bombs, said Anne when the vibrations subsided.
Her teeth were chattering nearly as loudly as the plates on the table.
I do hate when they try to drop bombs on us.
That sounds like an English gun, said Julia, picking herself deliberately up off the floor.
It's most likely a trench raid, offered Emmy. Don't you think?
Goodness, listen to us, said Alice with a high-pitched laugh. We've become such military experts.
We could teach a class at Smith, said Kate, her own voice as unnatural as the rest. English and German gun noises, the differentiation thereof. They all sat still, listening. Kate could feel her nails cutting into her palms, but the guns, German and English, had gone silent.
You see, it was a raid and they're done, Emmy said quickly,
but Kate noticed she was shredding the edge of her napkin. Florence dropped her own napkin next to her plate.
I'm going to go see to the cows. It's another full day tomorrow.
Bed for me too.
Nell smothered a yawn and stood, stretching her back.
If that was the big drive, it wasn't much of one.
Don't tempt them, said Kate, doing her best to keep up the casual tone.
Shall we take bets on when the next big drive will be? My money's on a week from Tuesday.
But it wasn't nearly that long. Kate had barely fallen into an exhausted sleep when she woke to a tremendous pounding, the walls of the barrack shivering around her.
What time is it? Kate asked hoarsely.
Emmy was sitting up in the next bed, her knees pressed to her chest.
It's just past four.
The noise was like nothing Kate had experienced before. It was terrible, crash after crash after crash, unceasing, unrelenting, driving out all thought, leaving nothing but raw fear and a dreadful instinct to huddle and hide. Emmy lifted her face from her knees and shouted over the din,
Will, someone told me they meant to pound the Germans to keep them from advancing, if it ever came to it.
I hope they can, said Kate through numb lips, but her words were lost in the sound of the guns.
The barrage continued all that day and into the evening as they went about their rounds, visiting villages, directing the teams harrowing the fields, hauling furniture donated by the Red Cross to the poor of Douai, trying to pretend this was just another day. Julia doled out headache powders without comment, possibly because no one would have been able to hear it if she had commented. When the guns finally stopped, a little after breakfast on Friday morning, the very silence made Kate's head hurt. It felt very strange to hear the normal everyday noises, like the sound her boots made against the thin floor of the barrack, or the way her breath seemed to rasp in the suddenly still air. Next to her, Emmy was filling her rucksack with handkerchiefs, soap, and combs for her weekly hygiene class at the new Civic Center in Verlaine. Kate took a deep breath.
"I guess your Englishman beat them off."
Emmy paused, looking at her over the rucksack.
"I only have one of them," she said. "One Englishman, that is. I can't take credit for all of them."
"You can take credit for whatever you like." Kate bit her lip, trying to find the right words.
"Emmy, I never thought you were a child. I never meant to treat you that way. If I did, I'm sorry."
Emmy's rucksack hung off one shoulder, the empty strap dangling.
"I know you didn't mean to."
She hesitated, but before she could finish her thought, Florence barged through the door as though she still lived there.
"Kate! Kate! Those blasted guns spooked the horses. Emmy, Alice is waiting for you with the jitney. She says you're going to be late."
"Thank you," said Emmy.
She looked at Kate and gave her head a sad little shake. It felt like farewell.
"If you look east and I look west, we should be able to find the horses," said Florence, cheerfully oblivious.
At least tramping through the mist hunting for horses gave Kate an excuse to stomp heavily. By the time she'd been hunting for an hour, Kate was sweaty and cross. Her hair was falling in scraggles from her chignon, and her shirtwaist clung damply to her back in a most unpleasant way. Kate just hoped Florence was having more luck than she was. They had parted ways somewhere just past the water tower, Florence going left while Kate went right. The blasted horses could find their own way back as far as Kate was concerned. She was meant to have been out with the store an hour ago. Except that they really did need those horses for plowing. Sighing, Kate flapped her jacket a few times for some cool air, shook a stone out of her boot, and trudged forward through what once had been woods and was now mostly scrub. The mist was so thick she could scarcely see a yard ahead of her, making her flounder and trip over things. She had just stubbed her toe on yet another felled tree, another thing she could hold against the Germans, when she heard the incredibly welcome sound of hoofbeats.
"Well, thank goodness for that," she muttered.
It was certainly coming on very fast for a plow horse. Out of the mist, not a yard in front of her, emerged a magnificent beast, all heaving flanks and glossy withers. Kate had a healthy dislike for horses, one tended to when one's father was kicked in the head and died, but even she could tell that this was a beauty of its kind. The horse's rider reined in sharply at the sight of her.
"What are you doing out here?" demanded Emmy's captain without preamble. "Didn't you get our message? The colonel sent a groom an hour ago."
Kate put her hands on her hips, sweaty, disgruntled, and generally not in the mood to deal with high-handed Englishmen.
"I've been chasing horses," she said sharply, "so I have no idea what your colonel wants. If it's tea, he'll have to call another day."
The horse sidled. Captain DeWitt got it back to where he wanted it to be.
"Where is the rest of your unit?"
"If you mean Emmy," said Kate, "she's gone to Verlaine to teach a class."
The captain said something he really ought not to be saying in front of a lady, even if that lady was covered in mud and sweat.
"What is it?"
Kate noticed for the first time that the captain looked decidedly disheveled, as if he hadn't slept and certainly hadn't bathed. There was dirt on his face and mud on his uniform.
"What's wrong?"
"They've broken through," he said. "We can't hold them. They're coming on, thousands of them."
Kate could feel all the blood draining from her face.
"Broken through? The Germans?"
Captain DeWitt gave a curt nod.
"Get your unit and get them out,"